Welcome to the Money Insights Podcast, where high income earners go to learn wealth building strategies that will take them from high income to high net worth.
Thanks for joining us for today's episode of the Money Insights Podcast, where we talk all things money and business. I'm your host, Christian Allen, and with me on the other line, my business partner and co-host, Rodney Zabriskie. What's going on, my friend?
Hey, glad to be here. It's hard to believe we're in the fourth quarter. We're on the way to the holidays here pretty quick. Hard to believe.
Woo, it is. It's looking like it. If you look out the window, it's just kind of gross, rainy, no fun. Yeah. So I'm hoping that we'll get some sun back for Halloween.
Deal. I'm sure we will. I love the leaves, though. That's kind of our big thing.
You love what?
The leaves, the change of the leaves in the fall. We do a lot of hiking and enjoy that.
Well, in Utah, it's a good place to hike.
Yeah.
Never run out of trails, right?
That's right.
Okay, so Rod, I'm going to introduce our topic. We're going to talk about the 4% rule. But we're not just going to talk about it at a surface level this time.
Yeah.
So anyone who's listened knows that we refer to it generally in a negative way,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So we refer to it often, and we'll, you know, define it basically. But today, we're kind of going to do a deep dive, and that's why we called it the 4% rule unveiled, because we're going to get into some of the nuance problems that are associated with using the 4% rule. Okay, yeah, does that sound good?
Yeah, we felt like we were using it a lot, and it's not that we hadn't, you know, defined it at some point, but really getting into the details, helping people see really what we're talking about, so that to give people some context.
Yeah, and maybe before we jump in, I'll just say this. Like, we work traditionally with, that's kind of an ironic way to say it, we work with alternative investors most often,
yep.
Right? But one thing I've noticed, especially because most of them are high income, high net worth, even though they may prefer to play in the alternative space primarily to invest there, it is extremely common for people to still have, you know, stocks, bonds, mutual funds, especially inside of qualified plans and defined benefit plans and things like that.
Right.
So we think that even though we talk primarily about alternatives, we feel like this is one of those conversations that's important to have, just because, again, most people, you know, which is better, by the way, most people don't have everything in one place. And so this is an important conversation for anybody who's planning to take withdrawals from a pile of money that they've been saving.
Right. The nest egg.
The nest egg. Yep. Okay. So with that said, Rod, I think the starting place is to maybe define it, but maybe define it a little more detailed. Like I said, we oftentimes will refer and give like a basic, but maybe define it in a little bit more detail so that people know exactly what we're talking about when we say the 4% rule.
Yeah. So just the real basic definition is that it's considered the highest safe withdrawal rate for someone heading into retirement, and it includes an adjustment for inflation. And maybe a little more historical context, it was developed in the mid-90s.
That was a good time for the market.
It was a really good time for the market.
Although right now is a good time for the market. It has been for the last decade.
Yeah, and we'll get into this, but that's part of the challenge, right? You you take people who are, especially if that is where they're almost all of their eggs are in that basket, and they want to retire. They want to retire when things are good, right?
Yeah, everyone feels better about retiring when they've got a bunch of cash. It's not nearly as comforting to make that big move when, you know, you feel like the market's on a downswing. And yeah, like you said, we'll get into that.
Yeah. So, but again, historically, mid-90s, you know, some people just sat down and said, you know, let's just figure this out. There's got to be a way to put some numbers to this. And so after running a lot of different simulations. Yeah. Benjen.
I don't know. I can't remember his first name. Benjen, though. But he did a lot of this.
Yeah.
So, okay. So, yeah, like you said, it was kind of created in the 90s. And like you said, that's kind of one of the challenges. Okay. So Rod, we have basically a smaller list than our normal lists, mm-hmm. but we have a little bit of a smaller list today, talking about really kind of the challenges or problems that exist within the 4% rule. So with that said, let's jump in. Number one, Rod, is that there's a big difference between building a portfolio and spending one down. Rod, maybe I'll let you take the first stab at this one.
Perfect. So the big thing that we hear about is just generally speaking, as it relates to having money in the market, is average returns. And when you are in this mode of building your nest egg and you have negative returns, it matters. Of course it matters. And and yet it matters in a different way while you're building that nest egg than it does when you are now spending it and living off of it, right? So again, average return versus what we call actual returns. If I'm in a situation where I can have a negative return, let's use a really quick example, just an extreme example, just to make the point. But let's say I have $100,000 in an account and I have a year where I earn 100%. That'd be great, right? We don't see that coming around.
That's a nice return.
Very often. But let's just say I did. So now I have $200,000. Let's say the next year I lose 50%. Okay. So I'm back to my 100,000, right? I just cut my 200 in half. I'm back to my 100,000. Well, if you take the 2-year average of those two, 100 minus 50 equals 50 divided by two, I got an average of a 25% return, but I'm in the same place I was when I started, right? So again, it's an extreme example, but it just illustrates the idea that the losses hurt more than the gains help. I have to have a higher return to gain ground when I've lost anything than again, if I'm just kind of living in the positive territory. So that matters regardless, but it matters even more when I'm now living off of that, because if I'm expecting to take money out of that account every year, and then I have a year where I lose value, I have fewer worker bees, and now I'm going to take some of that out, and now I have even fewer to for the recovery. Recoveries happen, right? Historically, you just look at it, the drops after they happen, then we have market rallies and recoveries. But for someone who's in retirement and is taking some of that money out, that recovery takes a long time. And depending on the rate of return and the amount of the loss and all that kind of thing, there comes a time where you just may not recover. And that's part of the issue.
You know, one of the issues, or maybe building on that, Rod, is just that there's so many variables that we just don't know the answers to, right? So we have to know, well, we can maybe plan when we're going to retire, right? That's not that hard. Well, I guess that's probably easier said than done, right? Because like you said, if things are ugly right before, then we might feel like we have to push it longer or something vice versa. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we generally don't know is the exact time that we're going to die.
Right.
And when we're talking about a safe withdrawal rate, we have to come up with a withdrawal rate that will stay in place until we die.
Yep.
So when we're talking about building money, the reality is that the most important thing that exists inside of the building phase is making contributions, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Putting away money is the biggest thing. Dane talked about that a little bit on our last podcast when he was just mentioning that the challenge, and I should just create some context. Dane Womwell, who is the president of NIW, he was talking about, when he was talking about Kaizen, what we call the retirement accelerator, he was mentioning that one of the factors that is the most important factor is less about the rate of return and more about the rate of savings. And so the reason that the retirement accelerator ends up being as dynamic and powerful as it is because it dramatically accelerates your ability to put money away, right? Because now you're putting not just your money away, but the bank's doing it for you.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to get into that more, but again, I just think it's important for people to understand that exists. Okay, Rod, so the first point or the next point under here we have is the how do you want to pick your number? So talk a little bit about the picking your number concept.
Some people may recall an ad campaign. It was probably about 10 years ago.
Gosh, has it been that long? I can still remember that orange number above people's heads.
So, and the idea was that you should be able to know what your number is. In other words, in order for you to be ready to retire, you need to build up your nest egg and get it to a certain number. And if you get it to that number, you're ready. You could turn around the next day and retire and you're going to be in good shape. And again, the premise of it, I can understand where they're coming from. And yet, how do you know? How do you pick your number? How?
Yeah, I don't know how you pick a number. Again, it goes back to the fact that there's just so many variables. And so it becomes impossible to do so. And really, most people just pick a number that they think sounds good, right? They're like, ooh, 1,000,006.
Yeah.
That's a number that feels big enough that I could live off of, right?
Yeah, well, especially if you're reverse engineering that and going, oh, hey, if it's the 4% rule and I need whatever, $100,000 a year to live, then it makes it easy. I just 25 times that, 2.5 million, I'm in good shape. But again, it becomes a challenge. And we kind of hinted at this a little bit earlier, but people tend to feel more comfortable retiring when the market has been strong.
Mm-hmm.
And yet if by definition you retire when the market is at its peak, and that's what helped you get to your number, and you're more likely to be moving into a time where the market is going to hit some kind of a downturn, you've just kind of sentenced yourself to the less likely probability of success end of the equation. And so it just becomes a challenge.
So, Rod, most people probably don't know this, but when the 4% rule was developed, it was using a specific ratio of stocks to bonds. So it plans for a 60-40 portfolio, 60% equity, 40% debt. So now this creates another problem.
Right.
And the reason it's a problem, Rod, is because if you think about, okay, so just about any advisor that's like doing a poor enough job to live by the 4% rule, they're probably also living by another awful rule. And that's just your investment allocation rule as it relates to aging. So a lot of people may know this or have heard of this. It's just, again, a ridiculous rule of thumb. But the idea is that as you get closer to retirement, that ratio of stocks to bonds should shift to go higher on the debt side and lower on the equity side for safety, right?
Right.
Okay, so, and a lot of times they'll even use the age-based idea where it's like, okay, whatever your age is, that's going to be your percentage of bonds, right? So if you're 30 years old, then you want to have a 70-30 portfolio. But if you're 70 years old, then you want to have a
30-70. Yep.
So here's the problem. If you've got a 30-70 portfolio and your 4% rule is based on a 60-40 portfolio, well, we have a lot of problems because even the assumption going in, you know that it's wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. And on the one hand, you'll have less risk, which is the point. And yet on the other hand, you're not going to capture the gains, as much of the gains when that's happening. So it is a challenge.
Yeah. And I'm not a fan of that, by the way. We're big in the alternative space, but as it relates to traditional planning, I'm definitely in the camp of being more aggressive longer term. The research so far suggests that most often that's a better scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Rod, we talked a lot about kind of the too many assumptions that exist there, but like you said, we've got a bunch of things we're thinking about. We have to go in making an assumption as to what the rate of return is that I'm going to get, and how often I'm going to get it. I have to think about, again, when I'm going to retire, when I'm going to die. Inflation becomes a huge issue that's obviously really difficult to navigate and have a good feel for. Even right now, Rod, like it feels like for how long have kind of as a group of American people been saying like, we're about to hit like hyperinflation. I've been hearing clients worried about hyperinflation for a decade.
Yeah, Or more, yeah, for sure.
Or more, yep. Right? Mm-hmm. So anyway, just again, highlighting the fact, the idea that there's just so many assumptions that it makes it just a really faulty premise to begin with. And so it's dangerous from that standpoint.
And when the rule was developed, they were assuming a 30-year timeline.
Oh, yeah, that's important.
Retirement timeline. Which, for most Americans, that's going to take care of us. For still a lot of Americans, that's not. And so...
That's true. I have a grandpa who is 97. I just went and visited him like a few weeks ago. He was like sharp as a tack. In fact, my grandpa, you'll love this, Rod. We go over there. Like I said, he's 97. Mm-hmm. My grandma, his wife, just recently passed away like a year ago.
Okay.
So how old was she? So they both lived. She was 95.
Oh, wow.
So they both lived a really long and, you know, fruitful life. But he's still got his sense of humor. In fact, and a little bit of a sense of adventure. He has this little dog that he just loves that he hangs out with all the time because he's like missing his companionship. He had been with my grandma Betty for, you know, what, 60, 70 years? Probably 70 plus years. Anyway, so this is a big change. But when we were there, you know, my grandpa's like cracking jokes and stuff. And then he's like, hey, you know, the other day I ran down to the... I don't remember what he called it, but it was basically a mini airport in Provo.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, yeah, I decided to go on a helicopter ride with my, I can't remember the dog's name.
That's great.
And I was like, well, how did, and she was like, oh man, she did great. And she just loved it. In fact, I think we're going to go again. So anyway, it just made me think of my grandpa who is still adventurous. And the good news is for him, he was extremely successful, and I don't think the 4% rule is really part of his milieu. However, the point is that I have two grandparents who lived past or to that 30-year mark that we're, you know, relying on as the standard.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry for that tangent, Rod. Number two, talk about longevity. Because that's obviously a huge problem.
Yeah, and we've been hinting at that already, which, again, because that really, it becomes the overlying thing. If we knew exactly how long we were going to live, then it would make it much easier.
That would be so easy. But can I just tell you, that would be kind of miserable? Like, I don't know if mentally I could handle that. But from a planning standpoint, it would sure make things easy, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, we joke about this sometimes with our clients, right? When we're sitting down with them, hey, okay, let's plan this retirement income thing. How long are you going to live? And they're looking at you like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, and if you can go into your planner and just tell them exactly how long you're going to live, then a lot of this just becomes so much.
Yeah, you have other assumptions you have to make, but man, that's the big one right
there.
But
that's the big one.
Yeah.
That's the big one.
So, but the implication or the impact of that they go in really two extreme directions.
Yeah.
The first one is, even for people who have done a really good job of saving, who get to that place, they feel like they're at a really comfortable spot to retire, and they do, what we've found is that they're afraid to spend. Mm-hmm. And we'll meet with them and we'll be saying, hey, your bank account, it's building up, right? You're not spending this money that you're taking. And they're like, I don't want to get ahead of myself. I don't want to spend too much. I want to make sure I have enough. And it's really a challenge.
Well, and you think about it, people in that, like, that are in that baby boomer generation were living through some of the most challenging economic times in history. And so many of them remember it well, or at least they remember, you know, what it meant for their families, their parents, or whatever.
Yeah.
And so the mentality is to be savers and not spend. And again, one of the challenges with going in on that 4% rule is that it doesn't allow people to live their most joyful retirement life.
Yeah.
And so, and it also just kind of builds on the idea that it's too simplistic in and of itself. Like the rule in and of itself is just too simplistic, and all these other factors need to be kind of considered in that. And certainly if you're, you know, if you're a retirement planner, you should be, you know, your priority has to be helping people live their best retirement. And I think it's probably fair to say that The 4% rule doesn't help you accomplish that. Yeah. Okay, Rod, what is the second end of that?
Well, yeah, the other end is that it can give people a false sense of security. So what could be less sure than a rule? If it's the 4% rule, shouldn't I be able to rely on that?
Oh, 100%? That's interesting. Yeah, that's a great point. Rules usually are pretty hard and fast, right?
Yeah.
Or at least they're supposed to be.
Yeah, so if I go into that and I'm just relying on that, it's going to happen no matter what. Regardless of what the market does, I don't have to worry.
Okay.
Regardless of what inflation is doing, I don't have to worry. It's done. It's set in stone.
I was listening to Physician Finance podcast, and they were talking about FIRE, right? And the rule was, and again, I was just like mortified at this, but the rule was 25X. That's what they said. They're like, oh, you can go to this FIRE world. All you have to do is have 25X your spending available, and you're in good shape. And I thought to myself, like, oh my goodness, like, people could potentially be devastated if they decide to try that out, right? Especially if you're young and you have a 60-year time horizon, the probability of success probably changes.
Yeah.
I'm just guessing. We're going to talk about probabilities here in a second, but...
Well, and you know what's interesting about that? It's the exact same thing. 25X your spending is the same as the 4% rule, right?
Yeah, it's the same. It's the exact same thing, right? But that's my point. It's still... in practice. And what's crazy about that is all of the experts in the space are saying that it doesn't work, that you shouldn't use it. In fact, we went and read 3 or 4 highly credible articles that were just breaking down how problematic the 4% rule is. Wade Fow, he's huge in the retirement income space, and he writes about this a lot because it's still being perpetuated, and it's really just doing nobody any, it's doing nobody any favors.
Yeah. And he says 3 is the new 4, right? 3%.
3 is the new 4. Yeah. Yep. 3 is the new 4. Okay, Rod, that's number 2. Let's talk about number 3. So on number 3, we're going to talk about, build on this idea of probability of success, and maybe introduce the mechanism that really tests that 4% rule.
Yeah, they have this thing called a Monte Carlo simulation, and it's something that's used in a lot of different contexts, but they started to use it in this context, where basically what they did was they simulate retiring. So the specific individual, John Smith, you have whatever, $2 million built up in your nest egg, and we want to play this out. If you had retired on September 2nd, 1964, this is what would have happened. If you had retired on February 3rd, 1929, this is what would have happened, et cetera. Right? So playing out, and I've heard a lot of different numbers, as few as like 500, as many as like 10,000 different simulations for this person retiring in those times. And then it brings back this probability of success based on those assumptions, and they'll run it at different levels. I'll say, well, what if you took out 3%? What if you took out 4%? What if you took out 5%? And then looking at the different probabilities. And so it might say, hey, at this 4% level, your probability of success is 80%, right? Which sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
And that's about what it is. It's about 80%. So that's a B minus, Rod. I think that's, by all accounts, that's okay.
Yeah, if my team going into any game had an 80% chance of probability of success, then I'm feeling pretty good about that.
Yeah, I mean, in sports, I think that is viable, Rod. I'd feel good about that too. However,
wait, you mean it doesn't translate over into this conversation?
Yeah, not
quite
so
as
much.
Easily?
We're not talking about sports. We're talking about the possibility of having no money as an old person.
Yeah, no, because you're exact. Because the success, the definition of success in that model is having $1
left
over.
That's a great point. Thank you. So that's important. When we talk about that, that means that there's at least a single dollar left in your account at the time of death. Mm-hmm. So there is an 80% chance that you'll have a dollar left if you go by the 4% rule. I say that, that's based on assumptions that are historical. It's not based on today. So well, yeah, that the probability of success is a huge issue, and we use these extreme examples, but I'll just throw it out there again because it's as ridiculous as it is. There's just a lot of truth to it, and I don't know about you, Rod, but I'm not getting on a plane that has an 80% chance of success. And that is more what you're talking about here.
Yeah.
Now, you may not be talking about physical death, but I think we can all agree that the world that we live in requires money. And so while physical death is obviously worse, you know, in your top three or four kind of most traumatic, difficult situations you could run into, certainly running out of money exists right at the top of those. So anyway.
And you talked earlier about some of the challenging things that our older generation has gone through. I would say a lot of that leads to a level of pride of, you know, like personal, like taking responsibility for yourself. And what happens if that person does get down to a small number of dollars in their account? Are they going to ask for help? Are they going to, you know, whatever? Or are they just going to bear it? And
all of a sudden, what are the options?
They're suffering quietly and nobody knows, right?
Yeah, that is difficult. And
it was probably about 10 years ago, I heard a really, to me, it was kind of scary at the time. It wasn't a podcast, probably a webinar or something like that, but basically the equivalent of that. And the whole conversation was kind of around this, but it was people who were on the other side of the aisle where they do this planning. And the comment that was made was, well, if you're driving down the road and you see a wall coming, you don't just go run into the wall. His point was, you don't just go run out of money.
Yeah.
You make adjustments. You turn the wheel, you slow down, you whatever. And
that's real life.
Well, it is real life. And the problem with that statement is, what is the implication of that? You've gone into retirement with certain assumptions of where you're going to live and how your whole lifestyle, what you're going to have for spending money, and you see the wall coming. Well, what do those adjustments mean for somebody like that? They're moving in with their kids. They're
That is a great point. I mean, you can do some more earlier on, but making adjustments, you know, late in the game is pretty difficult.
Yeah. So.
Okay, Rod, let's jump into number four. Which again, is another important one, but 4% rule does not account for what we'd call non-portfolio cash flows. So what do I mean when I'm talking about non-portfolio cash flows? I'm talking about anything that's not income that's coming out of your portfolio. So as an example, that could be things like Social Security. It could be pension, which, like, I realize is a dying breed, right? That'll become less and less of a factor. Mm-hmm. But for the baby boomer generation, certainly there's at least a good percentage that still has pensions. And then you get into like the types of things that we focus on, which is creating cash flow through alternative investments. Mm-hmm. And so again, the 4% rule is making this assumption that you've got this pile of money, this nest egg in cash, that's invested in stocks and bonds, and that's kind of all there is to it. And so when planning, and even if you're using the 4% rule, it has to be integrated into the other things that you're doing in order to have any type of accuracy to it.
It's a great point, because this is actually going the other direction. In other words, I can take out a lot more than 4%. Because I have these other sources.
Yes.
If I have these other sources.
Absolutely.
And
we want people to be able to if they're able to, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So like you said, you brought up the point of it can create a situation where people spend too little, they don't spend enough.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's probably maybe not equally as detrimental, but it's certainly a tragedy for someone who could have had a better retirement that ends up pinching pennies the whole time because they're, you know, going off of these outdated, archaic rules that we just know don't work.
Yeah.
Okay, Rod, number five. This is our last one. It's considered safe, but not guaranteed.
Safe withdrawal rate.
Safe withdrawal 80%. Rate, that's what it's called. Safe withdrawal rate. And again, it's kind of ironic, right? So 80% chance of success is considered safe.
Yeah, it is.
Where's that line? Where's the line between when they're suddenly like, dangerous withdrawal rate.
No, it's a great point. And that's actually one of the criticisms that I read about related to the rule is it's asking not just advisors, but individuals out there, the retiree, to understand the differences in probability of success between 50%, 70%, 90%, whatever all those things are. Like, well, these people aren't mathematicians. The whole Monte Carlo thing, it's really cool. The graphs look really cool. And
they do look cool. We used to use them.
Yeah. And
so, yeah, we like those Monte Carlo simulations.
Again, it's asking too much of somebody to take understand the implications between all of those different things. And even as I was reading that article, I was getting into all of these mathematical terms that I don't understand. I'm not a math major. So,
okay, Rod, I know you're not a mathematician per se, but we alluded to this a little bit earlier on, but I want to hit on it again because I do think it's a hugely critical piece of the challenge that exists in the way that traditional retirement planning exists. And really, number five is about that. We say it's considered safe, but not guaranteed. What I could say is it doesn't always work.
Yeah. So,
and that's the issue.
Right.
So anyway, talk a little bit about sequence of returns risk and how that plays into this.
Yeah. So earlier we talked about the idea that we have to make certain assumptions. What rate of return is do we want to assume on this? And obviously we did the simulations and all those kinds of things as well, which kind of takes it in a little of a different direction. But when I'm just saying, hey, I'm 65 years old, I want to assume 30 years. I have X amount in my account. If I assume X percentage rate of return, how's that going to work out for me? Now that X percent rate of return, let's dive into that because I'm just assuming that I know what would be a safe assumption to use. Okay. But then this whole sequence of returns comes into play where take the 30-year period of time and I know there are going to be ups and downs. I know the market's still going to be volatile. And so the question is, how safe is that assumption that I made on the average? And so think of it this way. Let's say that I retired in, 1950, after Great Depression, after World War II, market booms for quite a period of time. We see some struggles, again, the market is volatile, but generally speaking, it's up. And then in my later years, I hit the decade of the 2000s where they had the dot-com bust 3 years in a row where the market was down, and then it rallies for a little bit, and then it drops again in 2008. If that's on the back end of my retirement, I'm not too worried. I've already lived through a whole bunch of it. I got the ups early, but what if I...
Well, and that's it. There's just a huge power that comes to getting the return when you have the most amount of money. Yeah. Right? So that sequence of returns has a huge impact on both sides. Well, obviously the other could be true too. So if I start in, I don't know, give it a year, right? Let's say it was 2002. Mm-hmm. That could be a really problematic or difficult time. And even more concerning is the thought that you could start in a time frame where there's 2 or 3 or 4 years that are potentially down, which doesn't happen all that often, right? But that doesn't mean it couldn't happen. And so again, it goes back to this idea. Do you want to plan? Again, a real plan doesn't fail, right? So like it's almost silly to call it a safe withdrawal rate or to call it a strategy or plan when it really is just a rule of thumb.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. It's a great way to put it.
Okay, Rod, I think that covers the 4% rule unveiled. Is there anything else you want to hit on before we call it for today?
No, I think it's good.
Think we hit it?
Yeah, for give people some context. If you've heard us use it, you'll hear it. I'm sure you'll hear us again in the future.
You'll hear it again. You're
referring
we
to
love
it.
To bust it up. And like you said, we'll probably keep doing it. But for anyone who didn't have a good understanding of it, hopefully that's enough to, have some context. And if nothing else, enough for you to know not to use it. If we can accomplish that, I think it's a success.
Brilliant.
Okay, thanks so much for joining us for today's episode of the Money Insights Podcast. If you like our stuff, give us a review. We like iTunes the best. I think everybody does.
They're the ones that make it real easy to give a review.
Yeah. And a lot of these other ones, the gold standard, and they make it the easiest. Yeah. So anyway, if you like our stuff, it would obviously mean a lot for us, to us, if you give us an objective review. So thanks again for joining us today. And Rod, I'll see you next week.
Deal.
Thank you for listening to the Money Insights Podcast. To learn more about the financial and business strategies discussed in this show, visit moneyinsights.net.